Thank you for attending session 338, titled Toward an Inclusive Heaven. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Please keep that in mind. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. As you listen today, we invite you to reflect on your connection and access point to the topic. At Sunstone, we never ask anyone to adopt the opinions of others, rather to instead practice curiosity as an act of humility and empathy. Perhaps you'll find things you hear today that will align with your own views, and perhaps you will find yourself challenged by them. At Sunstone, we believe the wrestling with ideas is a critical part of learning and growth. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the end of ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of the time of that time so we can allow everyone enough time for lunch. We invite you to purchase food from the concessions just outside. A little about this session. What are some ways to think about how disabled, neuroatypical, mentally ill, non-binary, transgender, gay, bi, and others will manifest in the resurrection? Is a cured / fixed version the best we can offer? Who might be offended or hurt by this approach? Mitty Harrison is the author of The Bishop's Wife, multiple essays with Huffington and RNS, and was recently diagnosed with autism. We will now turn the time over to the presentation.
Thank you. Now I'm staring at my title, wondering if it's supposed to be toward instead of towards, but we'll just pretend that's a Utahism, and I'm just following local convention. So this is toward a more inclusive heaven. I am spending a lot of time wrestling with the idea of who wants heaven, who doesn't want heaven. I think a lot of people who step away from Mormonism, one of the first things that they give up is the idea of an afterlife. Some people really cling to that for various reasons. And it's part of my conflict in my own marriage that my husband really, really clings to this idea of a heaven, like the traditional Mormon heaven where we will see our daughter again. And my path through my grief has led me to the opposite. And it's something that is very difficult for us to talk about. So forgive me if there are people who love the idea of heaven where everyone is made into a normal body or where people have their various problems fixed. For me, the idea of fixing whatever problems, sort of in quotes, come with my, quote, disability, my autism diagnosis, is very fraught. And I think in the end, it may be more useful to think of my heaven as not a place that we go to after this world, but rather a place that we're creating here and now. But I'm going to tell just a funny anecdote before I go on to the rest of my presentation. I was talking to a friend yesterday about this whole question of, like, do people get fixed when they're in heaven? And she told a story about a woman that she knew whose husband was severely OCD. And this manifested in whenever they left the house, he would have to go back several times to check his checklist of things in order to make sure. And then he'd have to go back again. No matter how many times she told him, I already checked everything, he had to go back. It was part of this ritual of his OCD. And this lovely woman said to her husband later in life, I'm so looking forward to heaven when you will be fixed of all those problems. And her husband looked at her and said, but that's part of me. Those were not things that he wanted to be fixed. And maybe part of that is he can't conceive of a self that didn't have those things. I don't know what that is, but that's part of the problem that I'm getting at here. I'm the husband who says, but that's me. All right. I'm going to be taking glasses on and off here as I go. I was diagnosed with autism 2 years ago in January. People ask me all the time why I sought out this diagnosis. It's complicated. Some of the reasons that I sought out the diagnosis were that family members had been being diagnosed here and there, and I started to notice similarities between my behavior and their behavior. But honestly, the biggest reason that I sought out a diagnosis was because I wanted to make sense of my life. I had spent a long time looking at my behavior and trying to find labels to explain it to people. So I have certain kinds of OCD behaviors, and I tried to find labels for that. But when I asked professionals whether that would be diagnosable as OCD, they would say no. That's not it. And then I would find other sorts of behaviors and try to think, now, does it fit in this category? And maybe other people are not the kinds who need labels. I've definitely heard pushback from family members who say to me, you don't need a label. Why do you need a label? But I am a writer, and I need story. And to me, the diagnosis was part of finding a story that made sense of my life. And this diagnosis has made so much sense, not just of the things that I was seeking to make sense of in the beginning, the things that I noticed, but it has made a whole of a lot of my childhood memories and a lot of my family experiences, and I'm still working through that process. Okay. This is for those of you who, you know, maybe don't understand autism very well. These are the symptoms of autism for me. I have a tendency to take things literally, and I say this even though I am a writer, and I know I might have a PhD in metaphor. Like, I learn very well when somebody hands me a book that there's metaphor in it, but somehow that doesn't always translate to a conversation. And so sometimes I'm able to catch myself and realize, oh, that's a metaphor. Other times I don't catch myself, and I start correcting people or asking them, wait, is this what you mean? And again, this is part of the story where that behavior makes sense with a diagnosis of autism. Another one is difficulty reading facial and body expression. And I say all the time, I swear I'm going to get printed a bunch of signs that I can carry around and just say, like, sad, happy, frustrated, sick, because people can't read my facial expression, and I am really struggle to read other people's facial expressions and to understand their body language. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that people do have facial expressions, and I know that I'm supposed to look for them. It takes me a long time and an enormous amount of energy to parse them. And it frustrates me because I tell people this all the time. Like, cavemen didn't have language, right? So they had to learn how to use body language and how to do facial expressions. But now we have words. So let's use words. Words are great. I love words. Words are nuanced. That words can explain everything. This is my autism speaking, right? I want words to say everything. But that's not how social interaction works. Okay, another hyper precision in language. In case you hadn't already noticed this about me, I tend to use the exact correct vocabulary for things. I tend to have very grammatical sentences, and I will sometimes correct other people. For instance, if you're one of those people, like everybody on the planet, who starts a sentence and then assumes that everybody can like fill in the blank at the end of the sentence, I will fill in the sentence for you out loud. And it reads as me being arrogant or somehow that I think I'm better than other people. That is not how it feels from the inside. I just can't stand to let that sentence not be finished. It needs, like, the words again, the words. I love words. I also have a hypersensitivity to lights, noise, and other discomforts, which means that I get overloaded easily, and I tend to have meltdowns. Now, my meltdowns don't look like the kinds that you see in children where I'm screaming and hitting the floor. What happens to me, though, is I will go home after a conference like this, and This doesn't mean that I don't like people or I don't like having conversations with people, but it is a reality for me that I have to negotiate a world in which I can only spend a certain number of hours per day with a group of people. Because if I overload myself, I will spend 4 or 5 hours that night crying for no reason. I mean, my husband will sit there and try to ask me, like, what's wrong? And I don't know what's wrong. There's nothing wrong. There's no words that I can put to it. And for somebody who's a word person, not having words is very distressing. And one of the only things that helps is for me to go into a dark room that is very small, often the bathroom in our house upstairs, and to close the door and to push really hard, to sit on the floor and push really hard with my legs against one wall so that I feel pressure. And that makes me feel better because it makes me feel like I'm in my body again, because all of the hypersensitivity makes me feel like I have lost who I am. Okay, I have an annoying level of pickiness. Sorry, I'm trying to get over this. This is one of the main things that my autism therapist is working with me on. She's just like, you have a lot of rules. I have a lot of rules, in case you're wondering. I have a lot of rules. And some of those rules have to do with food. And she's been trying to get me to give up my rules about food so that I don't have so many problems in social situations where I can't eat anything because I have too many rules. Okay. Here's some more symptoms. A hyper-focus on extremely narrow areas of interest. Now, this is one of the classic symptoms of autism that people see all the time. Normally, people think it's about trains or phone books, memorizing numbers, calendars. That's not how it necessarily shows up in me. But when I was a kid, this is one of the things where I think to myself, if my parents weren't autistic, then they would have noticed that this was weird or like... But when I was a child, I would read series of books. I would seek out series of books that had as many books as possible in that series. And I didn't have to read them in order, but I loved those books because I loved the sameness and the familiarity. I loved the shtick, the pattern of the books. And so I would, and as soon as I finished one series or I couldn't get any more books in that series, I would move on to another series. And some of them were very strange for an 11 or 12-year-old girl to be reading, like, Sherlock Holmes, maybe not as strange, but James Bond, the iRobot series from Asimov. And some of those are because I'm interested in science fiction, but also I just love series. Another one is misunderstanding or missing jokes entirely. Like, I have a sense of humor, but sometimes I tell people I don't have a sense of humor because my sense of humor is so weird that it never matches up with anyone else's sense of humor. Over-empathy or under-empathy. Now, the classic thing that we see in depictions in the media of autism is the male autist. And for a long time, doctors would tell parents that, you know, 90% of kids with autism were male. It seems like now they're coming back around to what's, to me, a more normal understanding, which is that boys tend to get diagnosed more with autism because men and boys in general tend to get diagnosed, their problems are just noticed more. I'm sorry, this is a social thing that we have. Women are ignored more and generally expected to follow social norms. And so autistic women are better at following social norms. That is, but that doesn't mean there's no difficulty with doing that. So one of the things that they have found out as more women have been diagnosed, is that many women with autism actually have over-empathy, which means that they find it very difficult not to take on your emotions as their own. And it may be that that's true for men with autism, and that the problem is really the researchers. This is my theory anyway. My theory is that if you do not express emotion in a neurotypical way, people think that you don't have emotion. The reason I'm saying this is because that's what happens to me. I'm frequently in situations where I am in deep emotional pain, but I don't cry, and I don't have the facial expression, and most people therefore assume I'm not having an emotion, and they treat me as though I'm not having an emotion. It's very frustrating, because if I say to them with words like, I feel suicidal right now, they don't believe me because I don't have neurotypical markers of that. So my theory is I think that autistic people have just as much capacity for empathy, but this lack of understanding what facial expression means on both sides means that researchers have assumed that they don't have empathy. Okay, hyper-reliance on rules. I've talked about rules. If you know me at all, you'll have heard me talk about all my rules and my lists, and I count every step when I go running. It's one of the reasons I'm a good athlete. I'm not a particularly gifted athlete. Like, I don't have a natural talent, but I exercise every day, and I have a log, and I have books where for the last 15 years I have recorded every single exercise I've ever done, and that's just one of my rules. I won't go on with all of them. Another one of my major symptoms of autism is difficulty dealing with change. This is another thing where when I got my diagnosis, I was like, oh, it felt like such a relief to know that within the diagnosis of autism, that difficulty with change is normal. I struggle with simple things sometimes, like I don't like to sleep in a hotel room. I just want to sleep in my own bed. Sometimes I can fix that by bringing pillows with me from my own bed, but it's always a problem that tiny kinds of change. I go to a restaurant. I'm that person at the restaurant who always orders the same thing. Like, they know me. They know I'm coming. They're like, oh, yeah, you get pad thai with tofu. So I hate surprises. I hate gifts. There are a whole bunch of things that I don't like that normal people like. And so without the diagnosis of autism, it's harder to explain to people, like, please don't give me a gift that's a surprise. It is stressful. It adds stress to my life. And if you know Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory, my kids started watching that years ago, and they every episode they're like, "Mom, you're Sheldon," and I think, "Yeah, I know." Okay. I often feel out of place in social situations. It's something I got used to in my teens. I got used to what experts are now calling masking, which is very common for, quote, low needs autistic people. Just FYI, autistic people are recommending that we stop using the phrases high functioning and low functioning, and instead use low needs and high needs. Just because high functioning makes it sound like certain groups of autistic people are better or more desirable than other groups of autistic people. Autistic women often read socially as rather masculine, and for a long time I thought maybe I was non-binary or agender, and that may still be true, but it's also true that I don't understand gender. Like, I think ultimately I've just come to this place where I say, like, I don't understand what people mean when they say you're a woman or you're a man. I'm just, like, confused about that. I don't understand why having boobs means that I'm supposed to like lace and the color pink, and I don't understand why having a vagina means I'm not good at math, or why I'm not good at science, or why does having a second X chromosome mean that I will like shopping or wearing makeup? It doesn't make any sense to me. I tend to say things like, women are just socialized into liking those things, but I've stopped saying that now because I think I don't understand why any of that. I just don't understand it. It's just something that I'm like, that's an experience I have to let other people speak to. Okay, I'm also sometimes read as aloof, condescending, or rude, or arrogant. These are all traits that tend to be related to autism, and I'm often tempted to point people to the Star Trek character 7 of 9 on Voyager because I think she's an unconscious depiction of autism. And I have a whole paper that I'm delivering at a conference in October about science fiction and fantasy depictions of autism in aliens, robots, and the Fae. So maybe I'll post some of that later on. And I've been rewatching Voyager just to watch episodes of 7 of 9. If you remember the series at all, maybe you can remember the episode. I'm sorry, I should have had this up here, but this episode that I'm referencing here, she's assigned to work with these children and to like babysit them and help them have fun, and she says deadpan to the kids, "The fun will now commence." And of course, neurotypical people think that's hilarious, but 7 of 9 has no idea what fun is or how to make it happen. She's just like, okay, this is on my schedule, so now do it. But it reminds me very much of my childhood. My dad would take us on these long vacations, and I remember him saying to us all the time, "You're going to have fun whether you like it or not." And I think that was because he had no idea what kids liked. So he was on a vacation, so he would just do stuff, and he would just tell us, "We'll have fun. Because this is the fun time, so just do it." And 7 of 9 is great for a lot of times where the doctor is trying to explain to 7 what social rules are. There's an extended gag between them where he's trying to teach her how to go on a date and how to have conversations. And she's in the mess hall, and she's talking, I think, to B'Elanna and Harry. And she's trying, the doctor has given her a list of questions that would be like small talk questions. And she just delivers, she's like, Harry, where are you from? And he starts saying where he's from. But as soon as he said one word, then she moves on to the next question. Because she, and this is very autistic, it's hard to figure out for me the give and take in a conversation. If you don't just talk, then I assume you're done talking and now you want me to talk, and so I'll just talk forever, which is, I guess, why this presentation is going to be great for me, but maybe not for the rest of you. So what is read as aloofness in me, that sort of coldness, is actually an acute discomfort socially. I know all the time that I'm sure to say the wrong thing, and I don't always understand the social current underlying the obvious conversation. So to me, it always feels like there are the words that people are saying, and then there's another conversation going on, and I can't figure out what that conversation is. Sometimes I will say to people, is this what's that other conversation going on is? And no matter what people tell me, I don't believe the answer. Because like if I go up to somebody and say, like I'm having a conversation with somebody, and I feel like the underlying message in the conversation is, I don't like you, or you did something wrong. If I say to them, did I do something wrong? They are sure to say, no, of course not. Because everybody lies. This is how it feels to me in social conversations. There's no way for me to get other people to say the truth to me. That's what it feels like. Which is one reason why being around other autistic people can be very comforting, because I'm like, oh, they'll just tell me the truth. Like they don't get the social rules either, and they don't understand why you should lie, and so they will just flat out tell you the truth. And it may sound to neurotypical people that autistic people are rude to each other, but for us, it's very soothing to talk that way. Sometimes, and when people think of me as rude, it's often because I'm just blunt. And it used to be that I was very blunt because I didn't know any way else to be. And I'm afraid that now I've gotten so old that I just don't care. It's not that I don't care about other people's feelings. I do. I care deeply about other people's feelings. But I don't care about the performance of social charades. I'm uninterested in gaining points in some social system. That's how it feels to me sometimes that it is. And so I just don't do that. I will just be blunt. And I know that comes at a cost, but I've reached an age where I think I'm just willing to pay that. Okay. One of the most intensely autistic sensations that I have is that I'm distant from the rest of what's going on around me, partly because I don't get it, partly because I don't want to interact that way with other people, and that means I've become an acute observer. So I don't immediately have a sense of what to do, but I analyze everything around me 1,000 times over. And it's one of the reasons that I'm a writer. I see what people are doing sometimes more clearly than they see it for themselves, precisely because I'm just a little step outside of the rest of the social world. And I listened to a podcast yesterday from a guy who grew up with a severe learning disability. And he's become an expert in teaching other people who have learning disabilities. And he talks about how important it was for him to realize that growing up with a learning disability was actually a superpower, because it taught him to see learning in a way that people, for people that learning is much easier, they couldn't see the steps of it in the same way that he could. And I listened to him and thought, that is why, in some ways, I understand social interaction better than people to whom it comes more naturally, because I have had to work so hard at it. Okay, I know I've spent a lot of time talking about autism. This talk isn't really about autism, although it's partly about that. I'm trying to get at, in this talk, what we're missing in Mormon theology. Even though I have noticed that there are certain areas in my life that I have big problems with, that in some ways count as a disability. The fact that I can't spend a lot of time at a conference like this, that I have to be very careful on a weekly basis. I can only choose one event to go to where there are a lot of people. And sometimes if I'm having a bad week, I can't even choose that. So in some sense, that works as a disability. But autism is also who I am. It is deeply a part of me. I have a friend who has bipolar disorder, and he and I have talked about this, and he said, well, I bet you can't wait until they get a cure for autism. And I took a step back and said, no, I am not interested in a cure for autism. And we had this really interesting conversation where he was like, what? Why wouldn't you want a cure for that? I desperately every day wish that they would have a cure for bipolar, some surgery they could do, some magic medicine that they could give me that all of my symptoms would go away. And after talking with him for a while, I realized that he remembers a life before his bipolar. He has an identity of who he was before he became bipolar. And it was 25 to 30 years of his life before he had symptoms. I don't have any memories of my life before I was autistic. Now, I have memories of my life before I was diagnosed with autism, but the diagnosis did not make me autistic. So as I have spent a lot of time over the last couple of years looking at my life, I have realized that autism has made possible all the most important things that I am proud of in my life. Without autism, I would never have made it through my BA and MA in 2 years after high school. I graduated from high school in 1988, and I graduated with my MA in 1990. I was 19 years old when I went to Princeton for my PhD. I finished my PhD first in my class at age 23. However, I wasn't capable of holding a full-time job in academia at that age. You might imagine other 19-year-olds, or I guess by then I was 23. You might imagine a 23-year-old in the role of a professor. any 23-year-old in that role might struggle, but somebody who has social deficits, it was really impossible for me to do that. And it was even impossible for me to see what I was doing wrong. I knew that there were things going on, but I didn't understand what was going on, and so I ended up not being able to get a full-time job, even though I had the degree, and that was also very frustrating for me. Eventually, autism made it possible for me to return to my childhood dream, call it stubbornness, call it a mission from God, but to be a full-time professional, nationally published writer. And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Like, being a writer means that you sit on your butt. This is sometimes what my kids tell me. I sit on my butt all day long, typing words into a computer without any social interaction. My kids will leave for school in the morning, and I'll be sitting on the couch, typing away on my computer, and they'll come home from school in the afternoon, and I'll still be sitting on my computer typing things in. And sometimes my kids will say to me things like, Mom, I never want to be a writer. It's the most boring job in the world. But for me, I love the boringness of that job. I always know what is coming, and I am always pleased, to quote a picture book. I like the sameness of it, and yet there is a way to be different within that. Like, I get to explore different worlds and have relationships online with people in a way that doesn't distress me. Add to my obsession with triathlon to this, also something that I don't think I would have without my autism. Sometimes I tell people that I get 3 times as much stuff done in a day as any normal person would on a good day. On a bad day, I only maybe get a normal amount of stuff done. This comes at the price of having to take a lot of time off and to be very careful about forcing myself into social situations that are just too stressful for me to handle and that will lead to a meltdown that takes, you know, 3 days to recover from. I'll have a migraine for 3 days. It also comes at the price of ignoring a lot of stuff that other people pay attention to, like, for instance, the state of my house. Or the laundry, or my kids smearing peanut butter on the kitchen floor, or hitting each other, or the sound of a fire alarm going off. I can absolutely be so oblivious to the rest of the world while I'm on my computer typing words in this imaginary universe that I don't notice those things. Sometimes my kids will have to come over and shake me by the shoulder because I am so hyper-focused on those things. Again, it can be seen as a disability. It can also be seen as a superpower. So why would I trade getting 16 books published in the last 16 years, hundreds of podcasts, blog posts, self-published ebooks, 200 triathlon races where I place in the top 3? Why would I trade that to be normal? Maybe other people would, but that is not a choice I want to make. When I was more orthodox in my Mormonism, I knew what the answer to all of those questions was. I should choose the right. I was convinced that my view of the world was right and that being socially accepted was a sin that required me to give up my values. God didn't want me to be normal. God wanted me to be right. Now I see things in a rather more complicated way. And yes, there are days that I certainly would give up my autism if I could find life a little easier. If maybe I could hand off my obsessions and narrow focus to just sit and watch a comedy and not find it offensive, or to participate in a conversation without analyzing the way that person is holding their hands, like each of you, like I'm looking at you, like how am I supposed to interpret each of these body language positions? But I'm always sure that somehow people are angry at me because I have spent most of my life not understanding the underlying conversation, and then I'll say something blunt or I will ignore what people feel like are clear signals, and then they really will be angry at me. So that is frustrating. But when I'm healthy, I know that I would be giving away my birthright for a mess of pottage to make this trade. I have no interest in telling other people what able-bodied people might consider a disability, what that should or shouldn't be considered for them. I think that there are a lot of people who, even though I told you the story about my friend who has bipolar disorder, I think there are some people who have mental illnesses who do think of that mental illness as part of their identity, even though there are many who don't. And I think that we need to work harder as a society at allowing people to tell us how they want to think, how they want to, us to see them, and how they imagine themselves, what their identity is. Only we can decide who we are. It seems like we are moving toward a world in which disabled people ask to be listened to about identity, to be seen and heard, and not to be talked about in abstract terms, nor to be served as a group of people who are to be made more normal. This includes the deaf community, the ADD community, the neuroatypical community in general, and many other disabilities. For most of my time as an Orthodox Mormon, I believed that being on the covenant path meant following a rigid set of rules. It meant memorizing temple signs and tokens because I would literally be asked to go through those rituals at the gates of the celestial kingdom or when I was resurrected. It meant that I had to follow the word of wisdom exactly, never making a mistake, and that I should follow every word of the For Strength of Youth pamphlet. If you're one of those neurotypical people who occasionally broke rules and figured you'd repent for them later, I was never like that. I never broke the rules. I believed that I had to follow them absolutely correctly, and I really genuinely did not understand why other people didn't believe in Mormonism the way that I did. Mormonism was... Mormonism was the path to becoming a better person, and that wasn't a stopping place. We were on a path for eternal progression. We were going to be perfect, and then we were going to become gods. For me, godhood was literally shown in our artistic depictions of Christ and God the Father as two male beings who are nearly identical to each other in every way, physically, and who are emotionally and spiritually indistinguishable. They had become one in the way that we were to become one with them, which is to lose our individuality in favor of other traits of a perfect godlike human. I didn't go through these. Okay, this is the perfection of clones. For a time, I struggled with understanding how to modify the clear path of perfection that Mormonism described for a man, how to apply that to me as a woman. As a child, I just wanted to be a boy. I literally spent my fourth year... That's me when I was in fourth grade. I have an essay that I'm working on about my experience. When I went to school this year, I was named Eddie. They dropped the M of my name, and so I just told everybody that my name was Eddie. And because I looked like a boy, I liked having short hair. It was easier to take care of. Boys' clothes seemed more comfortable than girls' clothes, so I just wore boys' clothes. I had no intention originally to masquerade as a boy, but I also didn't really have any reason to not be a boy because it was easier to be a boy. My practical and also possibly autistic mother thought that buying me boys' clothes that year was just fine. It would make washing easier, and boys' clothes tended to be more durable as well. I loved my striped shirts and boy pants and shoes. My mother cut my hair boy short, and here's the visual proof. Later, I entered into a decades-long project of internalized misogyny where I congratulated myself for all the ways that I wasn't typically feminine because those made me more spiritually righteous. I didn't spend any time doing hair or makeup. Oh, points in heaven. Everything is about points for me, by the way. Sometimes my kids laugh because I ask them how many mom points I got for doing a specific thing that made them happy. Recently, I helped my daughter get medication for her mental illness, and she awarded me 200 mom points, That is a lot of mom points. I have never been awarded that many mom points before, but these points are very important to me. Again, like it sounds, I'm laughing about it, but it feels like this is a way in which I literalize the metaphor that all of the neurotypical people that I am around live with. You give each other points all the time. You just don't acknowledge that's what you're doing, and I'm forcing you to see. That's what social capital is. It's points that you give each other. Okay, didn't waste time chatting with other women, more points. Didn't care about how my house looked, lots of points. Dressed in a conservative style that covered up all my feminine body parts, points, points, points. I twisted myself into a box that I thought I was supposed to belong in, and it made sense to me that I would have to do this because my whole life as an autistic female had been the same kind of masking to pass as neurotypical. Now that I've rejected this idea of perfection, along with the idea that heaven requires a specific performance of self, I'm still trying to figure out what to replace it with. And that's part of the reason why I've written this. And forgive me if any of this the first part is boring to you. I'll be honest, it was scary not knowing if there was a heaven. Like once I stepped out of this really strict ideas of Mormonism that I lived with, it was really hard trying to think, like, what if there's nothing out there except us? So I'm still trying to rebuild what heaven could be after having given up some of these rigid ideas. And I'm trying to do without the idea that it requires sameness. And I think this is one of the things that, again, because I am a slightly outside of the social norm, I think that I see things that other people either don't see or don't want to acknowledge as real. But if we have this idea of heaven as clones, like God and Jesus are the same, it is very problematic what that means for us. It's problematic for women because we don't know, like, how do our bodies fit into that idea of perfection? But for everyone, it's hard to understand, like, does becoming like Christ mean that we all think the same all the time? Does it mean then that if the prophet says this thing is true, that we have to agree with them because, of course, nobody has any disagreement in heaven or in a divine world? I think a lot about the promises that Mormonism offers people who are on the margins. It's always that they will be centered once they're in heaven. The offer to the LGBTQ plus community, follow all these difficult rules and you'll be fixed in the next life. You won't have these struggles anymore. And we've begun to see how destructive that promise is to that community. But what about other people who are under the disabled umbrella of Mormon thinking? What about the promise that a deaf person will hear and that a blind person will see? That we will be restored to some physical point in our lives that qualifies as perfection. You know what I mean when I say that? Like, people talk a lot about, oh, whatever age it is that you're perfect, you're going to be restored back to that. What does that mean? If you think that your body was most perfect when you were 35 years old, I look at my mother now, who's 90, almost 90, and I think, do you spend the next 40, 50 years of your life after you've hit that wishing that your body was like that again? That seems horribly destructive. It seems like that you wouldn't be able to really enjoy then becoming older. So I have some problems with that also. Are we simply enforcing a norm of perfection where everyone looks the same? Are we worshiping a culture and able-bodiedness that is ultimately destructive and damaging to those we pretend we want to help? Are we just centering our own stories and giving ourselves permission not to listen to other narratives of goodness, of life, of being human and messy and not being perfect at all? I think about some of my friends who are deaf and a part of the deaf culture, and I wonder, like, the promise to deaf people, oh, that you'll hear again, what does that mean? Deaf culture is a beautiful culture. Their language is a beautiful language. The idea that in heaven, oh, well, you'll hear again, so you'll never have to speak with your hands again. Is that really the promise that we think that we're giving them? And if not, if I can imagine Mormons saying, of course that's not what it means. Of course, then what does it mean? I don't know what it does mean. To give up my autism would mean no longer being me in heaven. And I have spent too long staring at myself in the mirror, wondering if that person is really me, to want to do it more in the afterlife. I don't want to become a better person if that means someone else's model of a good person. I want to be more me. So forgive me, I have a couple of poems here. A poem started attacking me about a year ago in the middle of the night, and I'm insisting I write them down. And now it's hard for me to have a conversation with anybody without explaining something like what I think through some poem. So this is called The Hole. I went to her asking a blessing. Fill the hole in my heart, the yawning emptiness, the need for love and more. But she told me that she couldn't do that. No one can fill your emptiness but you. If I filled it, it would be filled with me. But you need you. So I asked her how to fill it, and she said that I had to find more of me. More laughter, more love, more words, more connection. These are not blessings, but building blocks. People once thought they could build to heaven, but that's not what they needed either. They needed to build themselves, not build their own heaven. And so I look for food to fuel this building, joy to grab and hold on to, love to never let go, moments to fill myself, the good and the terrible, the parts of me that fill the hole. So, back to about my daughter who died at birth. Don't I want Mormonism's promise that I will get to raise her again in heaven, as if there was never any loss at all? No. The answer for me is no. That is not healing. It is, in fact, extremely distressing to me to seem to want to turn back time. It feels like erasing the experience that I had with her death. It's hard for my husband and other more Orthodox Mormon family members to understand why I so firmly reject this and seem to persist in my mourning. I don't believe that God can somehow wave a magic wand and fix all the family moments that we missed because my youngest daughter wasn't there. And I also don't know who I would be if that happened. I think I began a profound change the day she died. Whoever I would have been, I'm not that person now. And I don't want to be that person. I can't want to be that person. That way lies suicidal thoughts. And trust me, I spent too long there already, so I'm not going to go that way anymore. You can't spend your life wanting the world to be fixed so that you don't have to go through pain. You can't wish that for yourself, and you can't wish that for other people. That's my daughter. That's a drawing that my sister did of her. Wishing away pain is useless because life is pain, to quote a famous movie. Anyone who tells you differently is selling something. So why would our conception of heaven be without pain? If Mormon heaven includes eternal progression, how can it not include pain? How can it not include our full selves coming with us, including all the problems and complications that being human entails? How can it not include becoming more aware of the way that other people view the world? It's a reflex for Mormons to want to fix everything. Have problems with your sprinkler system? We can fix that. Have a kid struggling with drug addiction? We have a program for that. Cancer? Okay, we can't fix that, but we'll pray for you, right? Russell M. Nelson says, this is a quote, eventually the time will come when each spirit and body shall be reunited again in a perfect form. Both limb and joint shall be restored to its perfect frame. And then, thanks to the atonement of Jesus Christ, we can become perfected in him. And Boyd K. Packer says, this is another quote, if healing does not come in mortal life, it will come thereafter. Just as the gorgeous monarch butterfly emerges from a chrysalis, so will spirits emerge. But what if you're the person who is being fixed? Sometimes we want to be fixed, and sometimes we want the rest of the world to listen to us, to mourn with us, to comfort us, but not to tell us what we should be doing instead. I have a dear family member who's very happy to share his opinion about what other people are doing wrong and what they should be doing instead. He claims that he wishes that other people would do the same for him. But the truth is, if this ever happens, he actually isn't that happy about it. And this is, in my experience, because if you don't see the problem yourself, you don't want to change. And you don't believe that there's something you could or should do anyway, and maybe you're right. Maybe sometimes the truth is a lot more complicated than what people from the outside see of you from the inside. And I'm just going to say here that it's entirely possible that talking about heaven with my mortal brain is dumb. and that me saying things like, well, we have pain in life and that helps us learn, so why wouldn't we have it in heaven? Maybe that's just dumb. Possibly. And that's why I end up saying, maybe when I'm talking about heaven, what I'm really talking about is a better way of us to live right now. And I'm okay with that. So perhaps a better title to this would be Toward a More Inclusive Zion, or just a world that we live in right now. Okay, I feel like I'm out of time here and I need to... Okay, here are a couple of quotes from Mormon teachings on the disabled. It's really common to come to Sunstone and hear people quote Brigham Young on race issues, right? One of the things that I think people don't acknowledge is that a lot of those racial quotes come with quotes about disability. Here's one of them. This privilege of obtaining a mortal body on this earth is seemingly so priceless that those in the spirit world, even though unfaithful or not valiant, were undoubtedly permitted to take mortal bodies, although under penalty of racial or physical or nationalistic limitations. The church seemed to lump all of those together, and what they were saying was, well, if you weren't good in the pre-mortal life, you agreed to come here into a disabled body of whatever kind. And nobody talks about disability like this in Mormonism now, but I think it's something we still need to grapple with, because I think that our conception of heaven is still tied to some of these ideas of racial, quote, racial limitations, quote, physical limitations. And this is another quote. There is a reason why one man is born black and with other disadvantages, while another is born white with great advantages. The reason is that we once had an estate before we came here and were obedient, more or less, to the laws that were given us there. Those who were faithful in all things there received greater blessings, and those who were not faithful received less. And if you go and look at this quote, it's more clearly expressed later in the quote that it's both about race and about disability, because they are seen kind of as the same thing, as proof that certain people were better in the pre-existence and certain people weren't. And forgive me if I say, I don't really like that way of looking at my disability as proof that I was not good in the pre-existence. I'm going to skip that. Okay, if you remember when Stephen Hawking died, there were a whole bunch of memes showing Stephen Hawking rising out of his chair and walking. And this is one of my favorite Stephen Hawking memes. Like, how do we fit disabilities like Stephen Hawking's into heaven? Because he was an incredible human being. He was also a complicated human being. He also was a bad human being. He did great things and he did terrible things, just like all of us do. And to flatten people with disability into, one of the other things I feel like we as Mormons do is we flatten people with disabilities into, oh, they're just going to go automatically to the celestial kingdom. This is what we've done to recover from telling disabled people, oh, you just chose badly in the pre-mortal life. So now we just say, oh, well, God only sent the best, you know, spirits to people who have disabled bodies. Well, that's not a solution to the problem either, because that flattens you and it makes you feel like, oh, well, everything you do is perfect, or everything you do is not done with understanding. And it's just more complicated than that in real life. I'm not saying I want to take away the hope of an able-bodied heaven from those who wish for it. And perhaps it sounds like a kind of relativity for me to say that heaven can be different for different people. But isn't that what we already do in Mormonism? One of my dearest friends had a brother born with Down syndrome, and normally the church doesn't baptize those who are mentally handicapped. But in this case, there was a long consultation with the family and the young man involved, and he was eventually allowed to be baptized, something he clearly wanted. He was now 14 when he was baptized. And he felt that this would help him to become closer to God and to continue on his own path towards the future. This is a wonderful way of dealing with disability. Instead of thinking about it as, oh, you automatically go to heaven, there was a complicated discussion. And this young man was capable at a certain point of understanding. He was capable of expressing what he wanted. And that is what I mean when I say that we flatten things. There's no need to flatten him. He had a full life. He understood things and he could be talked to. And I love that his Mormon ward let him be baptized later when he was capable of understanding. Okay, even the idea of Christ and Heavenly Father looking the same can be problematic in the same way. All right, here. No, I'm not there yet. Think about many temple films or paintings you've seen of Joseph Smith's first vision in which Jesus and God look identical. What does this say of our view of the divine? If we set aside the question of maleness and whiteness, we also need to talk about the way in which we assume that becoming like Christ means setting aside our uniqueness as individuals and a sameness of identity that is to be the norm. Yes, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking that this isn't the way you imagine heaven at all, that Christ says in the scriptures that he embraces all kinds of people and that no one needs to give up their uniqueness to enter heaven. You say that, and yet, think about the ways in which our doctrine does not hold up to that ideal. Think about the iconography of heaven's whiteness. When was the last time you saw any disability in heaven? And if your reflex is to say that all the disabilities will be fixed in the resurrection, let me ask you again to interrogate what that means to the disabled. It may mean different things to different people with different disabilities, but perhaps we need to start thinking of heaven as a place where people who are blind might choose to remain blind or deaf or, yes, even autistic or in wheelchairs or without limbs or even the mentally ill. Okay, I'm going to skip here to my poem. And then I think I'll just end. I have no wish for you to be a copy of me. I designed humans so that there would never be a copy of anyone, not even identical twins, not even clones. We're all unique in a universe of uniqueness. Doesn't that teach you about what I want? I don't need temples or churches. I don't need you to torture yourself into some pattern you think I want you to fit into. I don't need you to cut off your toes or your heel like Cinderella's stepsisters to fit into my shoe. I want you to make your own shoes or boots or sandals or platform heels or go barefoot if you want or use a wheelchair if that works for you. I want diversity. I want everything. The universe is a big place, and if there's a multiverse, it's even bigger. If we're all going to fit in here, we have to all take up a different space and be interested in different parts to occupy. That's who I am and who you are. I'm not sure I believe in an actual heaven, and if so, I don't believe in this with mansions. I feel like the Sermon on the Mount, if you're interested in rereading it, is an excellent description of what heaven looks like, and if you think about it, it's about honoring people's differences, and instead of looking at other people's problems, looking at your own. I don't believe in a cookie-cutter heaven. I wouldn't think heaven is a place where we go to be reaffirmed in our assumptions, nor is it a place where I don't have a lot of work to do to reconsider my own shit. Maybe you imagine that we can get rid of all the harmful ideas of this world, but who would we even be then? I'm not much of a believer in a tabula rasa. I don't think we're human unless we're implicated in a system of some kind. Heaven, to me, is a place where I'm surrounded with people I love, all the complicated messiness that these familial relationships entail. Friends are also family to me, so they'll be there too. Bodies will be lots of different shapes and sizes, races and genders. People won't be paired up strictly in heterosexual pairs. They will be with whoever they want to be with. If there's no sin in heaven, maybe it will be because we don't point fingers at people anymore, not because people are different there than they are here. In my heaven, there will be plenty of chocolate and coffee, Diet Coke if that's your thing, also cream, pizza fresh out of the oven, and there will be no gluten-free bread. Sorry. Unless you like gluten-free bread, I guess that's your identity. I hope that there's gravity in heaven because I want to still run up there. And I don't want to think of heaven as a museum because I wouldn't want to have to worry about little children running around and touching valuable paintings. But I love beauty. I'd want beauty to be everywhere in heaven. I'd want to have artwork on all my walls of all kinds. I'd want to be able to repaint easily and maybe learn how to create some art of my own. I'd want other kinds of art than just the paintings, though. Quilts and masks and gifts from other culture that came with stories to make them come to life. I'd want music. I'm going to admit right here that I don't imagine heaven being a place for me to be pregnant again. I did that 7 times, and I'm done with it. Pregnancy is miserable for me. I love newborns, and they made pregnancy worth it, but otherwise, no thanks. So I imagine heaven containing an infinite library of all the books ever written, ever conceived of, ever destroyed by fire or malice, written in languages I still have to learn, and that have yet to be written. I love libraries, and I always have. Does this sound like social justice heaven? Well, yes. I'm just going to finish with a couple other ideas about heaven. I'm going to ask for there to be no fake news in heaven. Clean water, fresh air to breathe, no more veils that separate us from God, from unending splendor and the overwhelming presence of the divine. No need for priesthood authority for us to know who has a good message and who doesn't. And I'm just going to end with asking you what you want heaven to look like. But I'm not sure I've left very much time here for you to tell me that. But thank you.
We have time for maybe one question. Does anybody have a burning question that you would like to ask?
Mine's not really a question, but maybe a response to your question. Maybe heaven can look like a place where all of us can be fixed from our need to have people be a certain way.
Yeah.
Maybe the real heaven is letting go of that need for all human beings to be just how we want them to follow certain guidelines, but to just let people be who they are.
Yeah. And again, sometimes it just ends up sounding like what we're saying is, this isn't about heaven. This is just about a better world for us to live in now. We don't have to wait for anybody to die for us to work harder at doing that. And I don't mean that you can just like flip a switch and suddenly everything will be fixed. I am one of the worst people in the world about judging others. It's because of my rule system and wanting things to fall in place. So I'm investigating this myself. I'm trying to be a better person. Yeah. Thank you for coming.